Hello and welcome to The Odd Past. I am your host, history teacher, and author, Matt Perry. Join us every week as we explore the weird, wacky, and odd side of our collective past. If you're interested in weird executions, strange ghost stories, haunted places, serial killers, and anything in between, this is the podcast for you. If you love The Odd Past, be sure to support us on patreon.com/theoddpast or check out our website at www.theoddpast.com. History should never be boring.
All right, welcome to this episode of the Odd Past podcast. I'm history teacher Matt Perry. Tonight, joined by two awesome friends to talk about probably our favorite topic on God's green earth to discuss, probably what makes us so weird, and that's serial killers. We're going to talk about the weird and often checkered background of notorious serial killers in world history. But before we get started, I want to remind you all to check out our new podcast sponsor, that's Flipboard.com. Flipboard.com is a great way to get all of the day's news without all of the screaming and name calling of the modern mainstream media. So check out Flipboard.com. So today I'm joined by two fellow educators, Emily Bailey.
Hello.
And Lindsay Ellis.
Hello.
All right. So I always make the joke that being an educator, you have to have pretty much a psychology degree built into it.
And that's what's led my interest personally into, the past of some of these serial killers, seeing, you know, what might have gone wrong when they were a kid or what kind of family situations did they have. Lindsay, personally, do you think that that plays a large role in some of the outcomes of these people?
I'm a little torn. I feel like that a lot of factors go into what makes these people the way they are. I don't really know for sure what the main factor is in all this, but I do think that they're just not wired like the rest of us. It's very, very odd.
Emily, what do you think?
It is a combination of several different things, and this is what makes serial killers so scary, is that nobody can pinpoint what makes them the way they are. I think it could be a combination.
I agree, for
their
sure.
Their home life, certain trauma from the past. It's just a combination of things. I mean, some of them, you look back and you think, they were just born to be a killer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just...
And that's terrifying. That's a terrifying aspect of it. All right. So we're going to start with Lindsay. So what I told them when I started this podcast, I wanted to bring both of them on because, A, we share a common interest in kind of like the supernatural. We like ghosts and we like serial killers, learning about serial killers and watching documentaries and such. I said, I want to do a podcast episode devoted to the serial killer that interests you the most personally. And so I have my pick. Emily has hers, but we're going to let Lindsay go first. And Lindsay's pick is who a defense attorney was quoted as saying, he is the very definition of heartless evil. So who is that definition, Lindsay?
Well, I'm going to talk about Theodore Ted Bundy today. And I think the main reason why he interests me so much is that he, number one, was, you would never look at Ted Bundy and think, oh, he's going to hurt me. He just didn't seem like the type of person. He was very intelligent. He was educated. He held respectable jobs. Never acted odd towards the people that he worked with. It was just, you never would have pegged him to do these horrible, horrible things.
And Emily, you brought up earlier.
So scary.
Emily, you brought up earlier when we were talking Ted Bundy was also quite a handsome fellow.
Oh, yes. He was very good looking and very well spoken and was very manipulative, I do believe.
That's what made him so dangerous, Lindsay.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'll give you a little background on Ted. He was born in 1946, and he grew up believing that his grandparents were actually his parents and that his mother was his sister. So already he has this very, very weird and odd family dynamic going on. It wasn't until later that he found out, when he discovered his birth certificate, that his sister was in fact his mother. And every podcast, everything I've read about Ted Bundy, it says he resented his mother for never telling him the truth. And he really never knew who his real father was. And I think he truly, that was the start of everything. I think he truly resented his mother for that. So, you know, we're starting out with the whole nurture aspect of the nature versus nurture deal here. Do I think that was what made him a killer? No, I don't. But I think that it may have had something to do with it. But basically, here's a little series of events for old Ted here. In the fall of 1966, he attended the University of Washington and had met a girl who stayed his girlfriend for a period of about 2 years. And then they split, but he still stayed obsessed with her. And he also resented her for leaving him. So there's another girl that is kind of making him feel bad, kind of going at his ego, you know. And I think it's just another strike for old Ted. In the spring of 1973, though, his relationship was rekindled with this woman. And he actually graduates from college. They became engaged, but he suddenly just stops returning her calls and calls off the engagement, evidently. And we had talked about this earlier as well. It's almost like he wanted control of the situation. You know, he didn't have control of that situation when he was younger with his mother. He didn't have control of the situation with this girl when they first split. But now he does, because he's just saying it's over. So that was in 73. And then in 74, he attacked his first victim. I don't believe that she was killed, but she was brutally attacked. And that was in January of 74. So then a month later, he attacks again. But this victim did not escape. They actually never found her body. And after this, on average, he was thought to attack women about once a month.
And that is shocking to me, because, you know, it seems that there's a warm-up period for a lot of the serial killers that we will study. You know, many of the big famous serial killers had a build-up period where they kind of, you know, they tried out what they liked. Bundy dives headfirst into the deep end.
Yes, but, you know, it was said that he may have attacked somebody and killed somebody before that. I believe it was a kid.
Yeah, when he was 16. I'm looking at that now. The one thing that I always have problems with is usually whenever a serial killer is finally captured, it seems that the authorities want to pin everything on that serial killer. I'm not saying that he didn't deserve to have it pinned on him, but I always find it hard to believe when it's like, well, you know, 20 years before his first confirmed kill, he killed a random kid when he was a teenager. You know, that usually doesn't fit into the mold of what we know of a serial killer.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I don't think they even know for sure. Like, he never admitted to that. So I don't think they really even know that for sure. It could have just been in his area, you know, at that time. And they just, like you said, pinned it on him. I don't know. But this is one of the most interesting parts of Ted Bundy's whole story to me. It just blows my mind. In July of 74, there was a lake, like a state park, where all the students would go on a nice day and just kind of hang out. And he goes to this park in his Volkswagen Beetle, which I love Volkswagen Beetles, but man, after reading about Ted Bundy, they maybe freak me out just a little bit, but but he goes to this park in his Volkswagen Beetle with a sling on his arm. And he approaches two different women that day and asks them if they can help him because, you know, he's injured. Well, both agreed to help him, and they were murdered. So he had actually asked them to help him with his sailboat. So I believe there were other girls that he approached that did not take his bait. And people actually witnessed him talking to these two that were, you know, that went missing and were eventually discovered to be murdered. But a description went out of a man that, or a guy that said his name was Ted, and he drove a Volkswagen Beetle. And he, you know, there was like a sketch made up of this guy and everything, and people would joke with him and say, "Oh, that looks like you." They would joke with him because they never in a million years thought he was the one. He had manipulated them so bad that they didn't even have a clue he was a horrible, evil.
Emily, he plays right up to what you were saying earlier. Attractive, injured, just looking for a little bit of help from a young female. It's the perfect storm.
Oh, yeah. I mean, who would turn him down, really?
I mean, exactly. I mean, he played it to the hilt. That's what makes these serial killers unique, is their manipulation. And it's just amazing to me. You know, Lindsay's telling us the story, and of course, he's going to ramp up very soon. But he's going all through the Pacific Northwest. I'm looking at the spots of these confirmed Bundy killings and kidnappings. He's at Central Washington University. He's at Oregon State in Corvallis, Oregon, Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. He's in Portland. He's at Keene County in Seattle. I mean, he's everywhere in the Pacific Northwest. And the MO at the beginning was all the same.
Right. And I mean, who would think a guy in law school, a good looking smart guy in law school, would ever pull a stunt like this?
You know, I was going to say, it's hard enough to graduate college. Ted Bundy freaking graduated. Everybody should be able to, evidently. I mean, if a sociopath can do it, we all should be able to do it.
Well, so, yeah, like you said, Ted Bundy moved around a lot. And, you know, police started picking up on this pattern of these multiple women, you know, going missing. And one time, it was, let's see, he was in Utah in August of 75. A policeman pulls him over, or tries to pull him over, but he speeds away. And once the officer caught up to Bundy, he was arrested. So I'm not sure what he was arrested for, but whenever the officer searches his car, which Bundy agreed to let him search his car, he found tools in the back, like I believe a mask and gloves and handcuffs and a crowbar, like crazy.
Yeah, I'm looking at the crime scene photo right now. He had pantyhose, everything you said, and a noose.
Yes. And let me add this too. Whenever he abducted those girls at that lake, he had a girlfriend at the time. And she had actually called the police and said, "This sounds like a description of my boyfriend. This looks like my boyfriend." Yeah. And they just kind of blew her off because they didn't think it could ever be someone like him. It's just insane. But she had mentioned too that she had pantyhose missing from her drawer, and they believe that he took them straight from her drawer.
Now, I had forgotten that he did spend time in jail, didn't he?
Before he escaped prison twice, ladies.
He escaped from freaking prison, didn't he? I forgot.
Yes, he did. He was okay in 77. He was in prison in Colorado and escaped. Let's see. He was charged with the kidnapping of a girl named Carol DeRaunch, I believe is how you say her name. And when he was sent to prison, he was also charged with the murder of Karen Campbell and was sent to Aspen. So then he escapes in Colorado, but is caught 6 days later. 6 months later, he escapes again, and that's when he goes
to Florida.
Yes, and he actually attacks girls in a sorority house and brutally beats and kills four. And then he flees from the college campus and kills another girl. It's
the Chi Omega murders were his, that was his crescendo. That was him reaching the absolute height of his, insanity. On one night, he brutally destroys the lives of five women, three of them killed. And it's just insane what happened in that sorority house.
Yes, it is. And I, in a podcast I'd listened to, it had said that a girl had seen him, like she watched him flee. How awful would it be for the girl that, it's awful for the girls that were attacked, of course, but it's, to witness that, to see the girls in your sorority house be attacked and then watch the person leave your house. Like, that's insane.
Yes.
Totally
insane. And I'm pretty sure he, where the keypad had been broken to the sorority house, so it was unlocked, and that's how he got in.
Mm-hmm.
Which is,
yeah. But I mentioned this here, and I'll kind of wrap it up here. He eventually goes. He wants to represent himself in court, which I think is hysterical. But it didn't work out, obviously, and he was sentenced to death row and was actually executed on January 24th, 1989, in an electric chair. So Mr. Bundy he only admitted to, 30, I believe, but police believe that he is connected to maybe over 100 people. So it's insane.
I always thought it was so crazy that the final time, wasn't he arrested in Pensacola maybe after the sorority attacks? And I mean, it was just for something wrong with his car. Him over because there was something wrong with his car, and it ended up being Ted Bundy that he had pulled over. I mean, they had been.
Yes.
Well, the one thing that I'll leave with Ted Bundy, I mentioned it when we were talking earlier, but I want the audience to hear it, is how sick and twisted this individual had to have been, because his regular nighttime job was as a suicide hotline operator. He spent 5 nights a week talking people out of committing suicide, and he ends up possibly being responsible for 100 murders.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't at all.
So we're going to move from a somewhat modern serial killer, and we are going to go to Emily's, who is the first confirmed and known American serial killer.
Yes, and that would be Mr. Herman Webster Mudgett, a.k.a. Dr. Henry Howard Holmes, a.k.a. H.H. Holmes.
Now, this guy holds a special place in my weird serial killer bank. He is a true nut bar.
He's one of a kind here. Like Ted Bundy, he was pretty good looking for back in the day. He was very manipulative. He could talk you into just about anything. He kind of started off as a con artist and worked his way up into this murderous creature that he became to be known as. So let's start off by talking about how intelligent he was. I mean, he graduated from I think it was Michigan, wasn't it?
Yes, Michigan Medical School.
Medical school, yeah, he became a doctor. He had several different aliases, 3 different wives, and I'm pretty sure he was married to all 3 at the same time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he did. Anything in his life was just to scam somebody to get money, basically. He stole cadavers, and then he would sell them. He would take life insurance claims out on people, and then they would end up missing or killed. Or he would stage their deaths to get the money. And that's kind of how he got his money, I think, to start up the murder house.
He also took some cadavers and actually got life insurance policies on these. He would say it's like, Bill Johnson, and he would just steal a cadaver from medical school. And he's like, well, here's Bill. Somebody give me my $5,000, please.
He did.
And these companies gave this man, like, it's insane how much money he made off of these.
Yeah, I think he pretty much got rich quick off of the life insurance scams that he was pulling. he had this murder castle, and it was there, the Chicago World's Fair. So he had a lot of people coming in and out, and it could kind of go undetected. I mean, these people were coming from all over, and he would kind of, I think the bottom part, were there three different stories to the murder house possibly?
Oh man. Let me look up a picture of it. Right. Real fast here.
Yeah. I think the bottom part was,
those were stores. I remember that for sure.
Yeah. And then maybe there were like living quarters in the middle, and the basement, here's where it gets crazy. The basement was like this maze of different rooms that was like a gas chamber. One had like vats of acid. He had like these airtight rooms and safes where he would murder his victims. And he even would set some on fire. I mean, just the craziest things you could possibly imagine.
Three stories. Yes.
Yes. And I mentioned that he's me because he doesn't really fit. Like, his growing up, he was well, his family was well off. He seemed to have a perfectly normal, good childhood. It's just anybody he was around or anywhere he went, somebody would usually go missing.
Emily, that's a great point. Lindsay, we forgot to mention this with Bundy. Bundy's victims all had something in common.
Oh my gosh. And this is one of the most important points, and I can't believe we forgot. He had a type, and his type was a slim girl with dark hair that's parted right down the middle. I feel like whenever I look at old yearbooks, that's what all the girls looked like, really. Like, they had that straight dark hair that was parted straight down the middle. And that was his type. And that was what his first girlfriend looked like as well, the one that left him. And then they rekindled and he split with her. So,
yeah.
You're saying Holmes, a.k.a. Mudgett, he didn't have a type. It didn't matter.
No, he's just in it for the thrill. He liked to kill and he liked to collect his money. So that's what makes him a little bit more terrifying. Just the fact that with Bundy, you knew he had a type. It was maybe he would go away from that type eventually, maybe not. But with Holmes, it was everybody was fair game. It was just, it's terrifying.
Holmes is what gets me is it is brilliant. Making money off of the killing of these people and the building of the murder castle. You talk about the intricacies that went into this castle. People, just normal people that were there for a hotel stay because, rooming was almost impossible to get during the World's Fair. For our listeners that don't really understand what a World's Fair is, it was extremely popular in the late 19th century, into the 20th century, during our boom of invention. And the Chicago World's Fair was called the White City because they had finally ran electricity into the World's Fair. And so it lit up at night and it was just shocking. People were seeing electric lights for the first time. And so millions of people come from all over the world, and it was the perfect environment for a monster to prey. I mean, it was just perfect.
Yeah, he could lure people in there, and I mean, they would go missing, and you know, there were so many people coming and going, and it was people from out of state, out of town. It was easier for them to just disappear, I guess you could say.
All right. So the end of H.H. Holmes is very reminiscent of Bundy. Bundy was electrocuted in Tallahassee, Florida. Holmes, on the other hand, also faced capital punishment. He was hanged on May the 7th, 1896. But unfortunately for old H.H. Holmes, it didn't go as planned, and he dangled for 15 minutes at the end of the hangman's noose. And before he died, one of my favorite quotes that I've ever read, a very self-aware serial killer, he said, and I quote, "I was born with the devil in me. I could not help the fact that I was a murderer, no more than a poet can help the inspiration to sing. I was born with an evil one standing as my sponsor beside the bed where I was ushered into the world, and he has been with me ever since," end quote. So Holmes was very self-aware that he was born with this, whatever you want to call it, this tendency towards killing. So that brings us to, last but not least, my favorite serial killer to study. And unlike the ladies, they could tell you about the past of their selected killers or their, you know, eventual ending. Mine is a little bit different. You see, you have to imagine yourself on the cobbled streets of Victorian London. And there's a dapper gentleman. He seems out of place in this area, because he's walking through the area of town called Whitechapel, and it is wildly considered to be the worst part of London, a place where whores, johns, fish merchants, sailors, and beggars all mingle and work to merely stay alive. Contrasting with this filth is this dapper man in evening dress, walking throughout the crowded streets and alleys, tipping his hat as he passes by storefronts and pubs, looking for his unique form of entertainment for the night. You see, London is on edge at this time. There have been two murders in the past month that have disgusted even the most disgusting of Whitechapel residents. It seems that a monster of the night has taken a liking to the streetwalkers of the town, and the beast has an insatiable thirst to explore. And on the morning of September the 30th, 1888, light shone on two terrible and grisly murder scenes. You see, at the first murder scene, Elizabeth Stride was found in an alley with her throat slit, a clean surgical cut, just like the two victims in August. But you see, the monster didn't have time to play this time. Something had stopped him, and so he goes looking before the sun would rise, and he finds Catherine Eddowes, a prostitute of Whitechapel. This dapper gentleman talks to her, takes her into an alley. If Eddowes had thought about the two highly publicized murders in the previous month, she didn't think about it then. She took the gentleman by the hand, and in the alley he pulled her close. And just like with the previous three, the monster struck without warning. A quick, precise, and lethal cut, severing her artery and leaving Catherine dead on the cobblestone streets. But this time the monster had time to act. He had the night's cover, and the scene when the sun rose was grisly. She had literally been dissected. Her uterus was outside of her body. Her entire stomach had been pulled open. Her intestines were to one side, and Jack the Ripper had claimed his fourth victim. Ladies, Jack the Ripper has gone down throughout history because we still have no idea who he is.
Wow. He's a very...
Well, what makes me always think of Holmes, and you brought up where some people think, oh, was Jack the Ripper H.H. Holmes when he, you know, did he just go across the Atlantic? Mm-hmm. And I believe where the comparisons stop is... Jack the Ripper had to have some sort of medical training to disembowel a woman in literally 30 minutes. I mean, it is just, it's beyond comprehension.
Yes, one would think he would have to have some kind of medical history like that. I mean, how could... I don't know how you couldn't. How would you know what... how to do
exactly.
That?
And, you know, some people at the beginning thought it was a butcher, but a butcher, you know, that's not the same animal, so to speak. You know, they called it the leather apron killings because they thought it was a butcher, but these were surgical cuts. There was no hacking involved. The only cuts on his victims, save for the last one, which we'll talk about in a moment, was the throat and then to get to her organs. He was a killer that did it. I don't know if it was for the thrill of killing. It was like he wanted the trophy. He wanted to get inside of these women, as disgusting as that sounds. But every killing after his first three, it was like he was putting on a show.
Yeah, I think he got more gruesome as he went along, didn't he?
Oh, his last killing, like I said, that we'll talk about in a moment.
Ooh, yeah.
I mean, the murder, if you want to Google that, guys, be forewarned, that one is not pretty. I mean, no murder scene is pretty, but that one's real bad.
I have a fun fact about that.
Let's hear it.
Do you know, that was the first crime scene photo ever recorded.
I did not know that.
Yes, she went down as not, and I won't say her name yet, but she went down as not only being, you know, the last of Jack the Ripper. I think she was the last of Jack the Ripper's. You know, I'll just wait and let you explain.
Right.
I'm afraid of something good away here.
No, we talk about the MO though. And so the modus operandi or the method of operation, he shares that with Bundy. It is always a prostitute. And they are always killed the same way. So if it was not a lady of the night, he didn't care. He didn't kill men. And so there has to be something. And that's what drives, you know, there's entire websites devoted still to this day trying to figure out who Jack the Ripper might have been. But there had to be something in his past where a woman had done something to him, just as in Bundy. You know, his mother had turned her back on him. He had that jilted lover in college. I would love to know what drove Jack the Ripper to do what he did to these women.
Yeah, that it just really blows your mind if you think about it. Even, I mean, I feel like every adult can probably say they've been in a relationship where they've been hurt at some point, but it's like, man, what happened? Is it just a matter of what happened, or is it a matter of, like we said in the beginning, how they're wired and a combination of what happened? Like,
The combination is what interests me so much, because, you know, when we talked earlier, we talked about the McDonald triad, where head injury, wetting the bed, arson, and, you know, I think that's it, right? Yes, excuse me. Wetting the bed, traumatic head injury, arson, and animal mutilation.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a mixture of multiples. Unfortunately, I did pick the Ripper because he's my favorite to learn about. We don't know if he had those things in his past. We do know that Bundy had a screwed up childhood. But Mudgett, a.k.a. Holmes, didn't fit into that triad at all. There was nothing that we know of. And so that's
right. So, yeah. So where does, you know, I don't know if we could ever pinpoint what really causes someone to be that way. They're all so different. They're all doing horrible things, but they're not really.
I think that's what allows people like us the ability to, you know, continue to research and continue to, you know, really dive into this, because there's no clear cut answer. You know, I mean, entire bookshelves could be filled with these psychologists trying to break down Bundy or, you know, any other of the long line of serial killers. But what interests me the most is not the way that Jack the Ripper killed. You know, so getting back to Jack, what interests me the most was something that we would see with the Zodiac later in the 20th century, what we would see multiple times. And that was, he loved to taunt the public and the police. It seems that that's where he got his jollies. He wanted to mess with people. And so there are two confirmed Jack the Ripper letters that were sent to the London Times. And the first one is called the Dear Boss Letter. So I'm going to read the Dear Boss Letter. Dear Boss, I keep on hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I have laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. That joke about leather apron gave me real laughing fits. I am down on whores, and I shan't quit ripping them until I do get buckled. Grand work the last job was. I gave that lady no time to squeal. How can they catch me now? I love my work, and I can't wait to start again. You will soon hear of me with my funny little games. I have saved some proper red stuff in a ginger beer bottle over the last job to write with, but it went thick like glue, and I can't use it. So red ink will have to be good enough. Ha ha. The next job I do, I shall clip the lady's ear off and send to police officers just for a jolly. Keep the letter back till I do a bit more work, then give it out on the front page. My knife's so nice and sharp, I want to get to work right away if I get the chance. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper.
Oh. Yeah, he definitely gets off on
oh yeah,
his work and letting people know, and it almost makes you wonder how it, you know, that he was never caught, which is so frustrating. But you would think that he would want to own up to that so badly.
Yeah, I mean, that's like I'm trying to BTK. He liked to taunt the police, and that eventually led to his downfall, did it not?
Yeah. And then, you know, like the Zodiac was never really.
No.
Either. So they are very reminiscent of each other. Now that you mentioned that. The Zodiac and Jack the Ripper.
They are. And, you know, the Zodiac did get away with it. But he was sending those. I mean, that's how he got his name. He would send like, I forget the correct word I'm looking for, like the cryptic symbols.
Yeah.
All right. So Jack the Ripper would send one more letter, and this one much shorter. You see, because not only was Jack the Ripper's letter flooding into police precincts, but now, as is with many killing sprees, random people are taking credit. Or it seems that everybody knows who Jack the Ripper is, and the police are having to comb through millions of, like, this gigantic pile of letters. But the other postcard that was delivered, we know, was from the killer, Jack the Ripper. You see, he had branded himself, and it gave the case what it needed to go from a London story to a worldwide story. And Dear Boss was only the first one. The day after the double murder, a small chilling postcard was delivered that bragged of what the author called the event. The chilling aspect of this postcard, and what leads many to believe it was the Ripper's second letter. I misspoke earlier. He had three. It was his second letter, is the fact that he knows the details of the murder that had not been in the London Times yet. And it is known simply as the Saucy Jack postcard. And it reads, and it's really in old English, so some of these words I have to translate. I was not kidding, dear old boss, when I gave you the tip. You'll hear about Saucy Jack's work tomorrow. A double event this time. Number one squealed a lot, so I couldn't finish her. So no ears for the police. Thanks for keeping the last letter back. You can print it now. Jack the Ripper.
Mm.
And so here's the final one, and it is probably the creepiest, and just because of where he wrote it from. Now, he wrote this letter to the you know how, like, everybody has a neighborhood watch service and stuff in many of these gated communities?
So, yeah.
Okay, this was to the head of the Whitechapel Neighborhood Watch. And it says, from hell to Mr. Lusk. Sir, I'm going to send you half the kidney I took from one woman and preserved it for you, the other piece. I fried and ate it. It was very nice. I may just send you the bloody knife that took it out if you'll only wait a while longer. Signed, Catch Me If You Can. And that was the last we ever heard of Jack the Ripper. Of course, he would have that haunting final kill that Emily was alluding to. So I'm going to let you, Emily, talk about that last kill that Jack the Ripper had.
Okay, so it was Mary Kelly, correct? And wasn't she in her boarding room?
She was in her bed. And I just brought up the picture because I didn't take my own advice. And it was brutal. It's brutal.
Yeah. I understand it is. She was going to retire for the evening, but she needed this rent. She needed this money. Now, this is all just from what I've seen on documentaries. She needed this money to... in order to pay her rent. She hadn't eaten in a few days. She was desperate. So she was, and she was a prostitute. So she was willing to take anybody who would pay her and have her. So in comes Jack the Ripper, which was her fatal choice there. And it was in her bed that he just sliced and died the woman.
Yeah, it's barely recognizable as a human, if not her face was still somewhat recognizable.
Yes. And Mary Kelly was, she'll go down in history as the crime scene photo ever taken.
So there you go. The story of my favorite serial killer study, Jack the Ripper. Obviously, Mary Kelly is his last known victim. We absolutely have no idea what happened to Jack. Many people believe, like I said earlier, that he could have ended up being H.H. Holmes. I find that far-fetched myself. But at this point, you can't discount anything. You know, there has been dozens. I've read a couple of crime fiction novels about Jack the Ripper, where people can just make up pretty much anything they want because we'll never know. We'll absolutely never know. So, ladies, after our conversation about serial killers, it's hard to put a bow on it to say, oh, this is what I think. And this is what I think it's nature. I think it's nurture, or, you know, we'll never know that. But the study of these people has to continue to hopefully expand our knowledge and profiling abilities. Do they not?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. Yes.
So I want to thank you two for joining me today. I've had so much fun talking to you guys, and I'm very excited to bring you all back very shortly.
Oh, we can come up with many topics.
I'm excited.
Many, many topics. We have a lot of favorites.
So many thoughts.
One of the things that Lindsay mentioned and that I kind of laughed about was you talked about, okay, which serial killer would you most likely be the victim of? And with me being a somewhat larger white guy, Dahmer would have loved me.
Oh, perfect.
He could have snacked on me for a while. Emily, that flower child persona, you got to watch out if you parted your hair the wrong way.
Oh, I know. I am a straight down the middle kind of girl. So.
And
but she's a blonde.
I'm a blondie.
She's a blonde. You're right. You're right. That's why, Lindsay, I brought that up. You're like, nope, he would have left me alone because you're a blonde. But, you know.
But if he would have approached me 16, 17 years ago, I'm a brunette. So I would have fit the profile. Unfortunately.
All right, ladies, I had so much fun with you, and I want to thank everybody that is listening for checking out the Odd Past podcast. If you want to support the Odd Past, there's many ways to do it. Check out theoddpast.com or head out to patreon.com/theoddpast, and remember to check out flipbook.com, our new sponsor and a great way to get your daily news. So until next time, this is Matt Perry for Emily Bailey and Lindsay Ellis saying goodbye, and history should never be boring. Take it easy, guys.